Thank you, Brother Joel. We've had a good overview of the returns, and I'll call them returns because obviously there was more than one. And now we're going to look at the rebuilding. Now, if we were to try and look at the various episodes of rebuilding, we would be here for the rest of the weekend. So all I can try to do for you now is to give you an overview. And I'm going to probably skip some of the things that many of you know and hopefully bring out a few fresh things or ideas so that we can think about this subject. And I would say at the outset, if you really want to get into the detail, then read Brother Steve's book, because there's an awful lot of interesting facts there. I actually want to start with a couple of quotations from Scripture. The first one from Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, its builders labour in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stand guard in vain. And one from the Master in the New Testament, from Luke 14. Again, you'll know the words. Luke 14, a reading from verse 28. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build and was not able to finish. Just bear those in mind. So, what about rebuilding? What needed rebuilding? Actually, there were three projects. The first was rebuilding the temple as a centre of worship, and we've heard a little bit about that from Joel. Secondly, there was the rebuilding of Jerusalem as a city, the re-establishment of the walls, both physically and symbolically. And last but not least, there was rebuilding a nation, which had for many years been scattered and almost lost its identity. So then, on this rebuilding. Firstly, the temple. What was planned? Well, we read in Ezra, didn't we, 1? What was planned? The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me, said Cyrus, all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. That's the story. That's what is recorded there. It's what's recorded in Chronicle. And that's what the Jews who returned under Zerubbabel thought was the decree. Now, you probably detect a little reticence in my voice there, because the reality was a little bit different. Ezra 6. We're skipping over, and don't please try and get too much historical out of my address, because if I just put it in historical context, we get even more confused. This is a later time when those that were against the Jews, and there were plenty of them, were actually telling head office back in Babylon, listen, go check, make sure that this building that they say they're doing has been authorised. And what they found was the original government documents, the original record. And so we read in Ezra 6, verse 3, in the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifices. Let its foundations be laid. It is to be 90 feet high and 90 feet wide, with three courses of large stones and one of timbers. The costs are to be paid by the royal treasury. Also, the gold, silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, are to be returned to their places in the temple in Jerusalem. They are to be deposited in the house of God. Now, we are talking about a civilized society. A civilized society with civil servants. So when we read in Ezra about the list of all those things that had been taken out of the temple of God in Jerusalem that were going to be returned, it's a detailed list, because that's what they kept, detailed lists. And there's a detailed account here of the size of the temple that Cyrus decreed. It wasn't talking about rebuilding the temple of Solomon. He was talking about something that was nearly, certainly three times as wide and three times as high. A much bigger temple. And that's the first thing that we've got to think about. Although it was part of this Persian creed to re-establish religions, part of it was for Cyrus himself to say, well, I've helped you out, I've built your temple. Now, reality was, as we will find, that temple actually never got built. Cyrus's temple never got built. In fact, the closest they got to it was when Herod built himself a temple. And do you remember it was always called Herod's temple? Well, that's about the same size as Cyrus's temple, about three times as big as Solomon's. That's the first little point to think about while we're thinking about this rebuilding. What about the funding? Well, in Ezra 1, we read that the people of the place where survivors may now be living are to provide him with silver and gold. There's absolutely nothing in there about the treasury doing it. Now, is this a discrepancy between what is recorded in Ezra and what, 1 and what is recorded in Ezra 6? I don't think so. And nor do others have looked at it. What is recorded in Ezra 1 is the decree that the Jews took back with them. We have to remember at this time that the Jews were not always welcome. They were not always liked. So what Cyrus decreed and what actually happened could be slightly different and modified. You can imagine the treasury saying, well, we're not paying for it. Let them pay for it. And so it slightly changes. Slightly changes at the start. So we'll see. God's purpose is going to take place. Things do change. There was internal opposition to this going back. It's implied there. But they still went back. They still went back with an idea of rebuilding. Firstly, to rebuild the temple. And Brother Joel's already mentioned in Ezra 3 this establishment of sacrifices on the altar. Before the foundations had even been sought out, the first thing to do was to sacrifice to God. Why? Well, to thank him first and foremost that they had been allowed to come back. We're talking about a reasonable number of people. 42, 44, maybe 50,000 altogether. That's a big influx to the land. It's fairly important that they establish what they're doing. They were there under the decree of Cyrus to establish worship. That was their authority. That's what gave them the right to be there at the time. And their motivation was right. They planned it. They sorted it. What we read, they gave money, verse 7 of Ezra 3, to the masons and carpenters, gave food and drink and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre. That's interesting. So the craftsmen are involved, the masons and the carpenters. Masons, of course, for the stone, carpenters for the wood. And they need to get wood. They need to bring in cedar logs. So they give food, drink and oil to the people of Sidon and Tyre. Now, why would the people of Sidon and Tyre need extra food, drink and oil? Well, because they were also under control. They'd been overrun. So this is helping them out. It's oiling the wheels. It's making sure your suppliers are right so you get the right materials. But, of course, they weren't working as Solomon was with brand new materials. What happened? What had happened before was that the temple and Jerusalem had been destroyed. Firstly, by fire. Now, fire, of course, will destroy all the timber work. That's why you need new timbers. But fire also messes around with masonry. It splits rocks. It softens stones. It changes them. And this is the materials that they had to work with. Reuse what was there. And this is probably why, when we read that those who understood the formal temple wept aloud when they saw the foundations of the temple being laid. It wasn't as good as Solomon's. They were making do with what was there. But the most important thing is, it was being established. The foundations were being laid. And then we come to the next bit, which is now consistent throughout all the building period. Ezra 4. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, and let's get it right, their enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and be sacrificing him to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." Well, yeah, they might have been sacrificing to him as well as sacrificing to all the other gods. And we know that that appears so much through the record, doesn't it? No, they wanted to get in on the inside. They wanted to help, in inverted commas, the work. They wanted to know what was going on. But Zerubbabel, Jeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." In other words, here's our authority. We are building a Jewish temple for the Jews in their land. You might be living here, but we've come back and we're establishing ourselves. Interesting, isn't it, how history repeats itself? Right down to this very day. And of course, these were the enemies. So the people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah, make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them, frustrate their plans. During the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And they were very cunning, the opposition. It's very interesting that human nature and politics don't really change. So while they are building, and bearing in mind the decree was to build the temple, establish worship there, that wasn't actually what those in opposition wrote back to Artaxerxes. No, we're not going to go into the detail, but what they said, well, these Jews are over here and they're rebuilding the city. They're going to establish it and they're going to be against you. They're going to establish their nation. Well, yes, that was in the plan of God. Yes, that is what was going to happen, but that's not what the decree of Cyrus said. That's not what the authority was, and up until this stage, that's not what the Jews had done. They were building the temple. But things can be changed. And of course, when he searched his records, he said, well, there's no authority to rebuild the city. You better stop. So suddenly, all their official authorization was taken away from them. And as soon as that letter came back, is Ezra 4, verse 23. As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem and compelled them by force to stop. Now that's interesting too. They compelled them by force. They had to stop them working. So at that stage, they were all still keen to get on. Now they were compelled to stop. The work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill. It stopped. It finished. That could have been the end of it, couldn't it? This is the purpose of God. God's purpose will not be undermined. It is going to take place. And when the people were down and needed encouragement, what did he do in the past? He sent prophets to them. And so that's what happens. God sends them Haggai and Zechariah, those two prophets. Now, we can't, again, go into a lot of detail now about Haggai and Zechariah. What we can do is we can go to the beginning of Haggai and just see how his prophecy starts. The time period is set in verse 1, but verse 2. This is what the Lord Almighty says. This people say, the time has not yet come for the Lord's house to be built. What happened to the people is that they were disillusioned. They became disillusioned. They'd been stopped. Their authority had been taken away to build. Now, what have they got? Well, they've got a lot of reconstituted stone. They've got a lot of building materials. They've got a nice lot of fresh cedar from Lebanon. Such a shame. If it can't be used on the temple, well, we might have the odd bit and build our houses then. It's human nature, isn't it? Human nature comes in. They started using materials which should have been dedicated to God for the building of temple to build their own houses. Now, who do you think started this? Do you think it was the everyday workmen, or do you think it was the nobles and the leaders that went there? We'll get the full answer a little bit later, but I'm sure you know what it is. And so the word of the Lord comes through Haggai. Is it a time for you yourselves to be living in your panelled houses while this house remains a ruin? It would not be normal for people to live in wood panelled houses unless you'd got a lot of surplus wood. The people had not taken long to go away from the original task that they had been set. Yes, reasons were there. Those reasons weren't valid if they were correctly worshipping God. And God sends Haggai, especially as an old-fashioned seer, a crier out. Get back to work. Get on with it. There's work to be done. Zechariah does it in a more subtle way. Zechariah does it looking at the spiritual side. He has a big go at the high priest. It says you're cohorting with Satan. Your robes aren't worth what they were. You've denigrated them. But you can change. And if you change, I'll promise you a fabulous kingdom in the future. And that's why we get those lovely pictures of Zechariah of the kingdom of the future, to encourage the people to go back to God. And even the high priest himself turned. He'd associate himself with the people of the land. It's a lot easier, isn't it, to get on with people rather than being in opposition to them. But that's how subtly things come in. And so, because of the work of Haggai and Zechariah, then building starts again. Ezra 5 now. And we'll read from the beginning of the chapter. Now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God of Israel, who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, son of Jozadak, set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, helping them. Yet they got together again, and they started again. They started to work, to build, to do the job. Now, by this time, the governor of the region had changed, and their associates go up and say, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and construct this building? And here we have it. But the eye of God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his written reply be received. Now, here's the interesting bit. The letter goes from them saying, these Jews are building a temple. No lies this time. No saying they're building the city and they're going to rebel. They're building a temple, and they said they've been given authority to do so. Can you check it out, please? Well, of course, it was checked out. It was looked in the records. And that's where we find this memorandum, it says in my NIV. The note in the records about what Cyrus actually said. And then Darius takes it a step further. And this is where things really start to happen. He says, now then, Tatnai, with Ezra 6 and verse 6, governor of Trans-Euphrates, you fellow officials of the province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on the temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you are to do to these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. The expenses of the men are to be fully paid out of the royal treasury. So he circumnavigated the old civil servants who'd stopped the paying out and says it's going to come out of the royal treasury, and then does something which is quite clever. It's going to come from the revenues of Trans-Euphrates. So the area you're governing, instead of passing your revenues to me, you can pass them to the Jews. What a turnaround. Now that turnaround would not have happened. That rebuilding could not have started again and been supported were God not behind it. And Darius put even more authority on it. Verse 11, I decree that if anyone changes this edict, a beam is to be pulled from his house and he's to be lifted up and impaled on it. And for this crime, his house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. And of course, the result was the temple got built. They had nothing to hamper them now. They got the materials, they got the revenue, they got the workers, and no immediate opposition. With the result that the work of establishing the temple happened as God says it would. 20 years after that first return. It took 20 years to establish a temple on the site and establish worship. The problem is, in 20 years, people lose guidance. And so Ezra is appointed to return to sort things out. And we read a little bit, didn't we, about the return of Ezra. But you see, Ezra came with a lot of authority. A lot of authority. We read verse 6 of Ezra 7. Ezra 7 verse 6, yeah. This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher well versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him everything he asked. From the hand of the Lord his God was on him. Some of the Israelites, including priests, Levites, singers, gatekeepers, temple servants, also came up to Jerusalem in the 7th year of King Artaxerxes. And Ezra arrived in Jerusalem in the 5th month of the 7th year of the king. It took him 3 months to do that journey. And we read here, before he started the journey, he prayed to God for his support. Ezra, from the start, set his mind in the right way. He was going to do the word of God. And he was given the authority to do so. With God's help, Ezra was in control. He could control the opposition because he had the authority of the king. But more importantly, verse 27 of Ezra 7. Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put it into the king's heart to bring honour to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and who has extended his good favour to me before the king and his advisers and all the king's powerful officials. Because the hand of the Lord my God was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me. Back on track. The rebuilding work is back on track. It is established and things are apparently working well. Apart from the fact that when Ezra had not been on the scene, things had not been going straight. What had happened, as always happened, the people had not completely separated themselves from the people of the land. They have, to use a modern phrase, integrated themselves. They'd intermarried. They were all linked. They weren't doing all the right things. And so part of Ezra's work was to do this restoration of the nation, to show them that they had separated from God, that their way of worship wasn't the right one. They couldn't do it their way. They couldn't work alongside these people who professed to serve the God of Israel, but served other gods as well. It had to be done in the right way. And so although the temple had been rebuilt, right, then the nation needed rebuilding. And Ezra worked hard on that to show them where they were wrong. And when I say worked hard, Ezra 10, verse 1. While Ezra was praying and confessing and weeping and throwing himself down before the house of God, a large crowd of Israelites, men, women and children, gathered round him. They too wept bitterly. And then they admitted that they had done wrong. Not only did they admit that they'd done wrong, they admitted that they needed to do something about it. And not just saying, well, we need to do something about it. They actually did it. A proclamation was then issued throughout Judah and Jerusalem for all the exiles to assemble in Jerusalem. Anyone who failed to appear within 3 days would forfeit all his property in accordance with the decision of the officials and elders, and would himself be expelled from the assembly of the exiles. Now there's some authority, and they sorted this out for themselves. They agreed that they needed to do something about it. And there's a great analysis there of all those that had intermarried, and they sorted it all out. They got it all straight as much as they possibly could. And so we get a period in the rebuilding where we have worship as best as it could be in those circumstances. A nation pulled together, excluding its foreign influences. And we now move on to the next phase, which is the phase with Nehemiah. What motivated Nehemiah? Why did Nehemiah start out and decide that he needed to get out to the land and do something? On a human point of view, because his brother came from Jerusalem and told him what a state it was in. It's simple as that. It's that family connection. His brother Hanani turns up and says, and he questions them, what's it like? How are they doing? They survived the exile. What about Jerusalem? Those who survived the exile back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. Its gates have been burned with fire. Nothing there about the temple. Nothing there about Ezra's work and re-establishing. No, it's about identity. It's about having their own city. A city which had been broken down and destroyed. And so we get then those wonderful prayers and that time of anguish that Nehemiah had before he was able to answer the king. But more than that, the hand of God's in all this, isn't it? I am convinced by looking at the studies of others and looking at it for myself that this king, there is a mention here of him doing it in front of the king and the queen. I'm absolutely certain the queen was Esther. This was the right time. You've got a pro-Jewish lobby working in central government. Not only that, the central government has been set up by Mordecai the Jew. When was the best time for Nehemiah to be released to go and establish a city? When the kingdom was pro-Jewish. None of this, they're going to rise up against you and rebel against you. A lot of the senior people in government at the time working for the king were Jewish. It's probably why Nehemiah was there as the cupbearer in the first place. God had arranged the circumstances so Nehemiah could go back and start the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Now he goes back. What does he find when he gets back? He finds the place in a state, not just physically, but spiritually. He finds out that the people once again have totally integrated themselves with those that are around. And worse than that, the two leaders at the time out there, non-Jews, Sanballat and Tobiah, have got everybody, as much as they possibly could, in their pay, either by intermarriage, bribery, whatever. The whole shenanigan has all gone wrong again. So even though he had the authority, Nehemiah has almost got to start again on his work. And Nehemiah was a practical man. So he sneaks out at night. And he gets on a horse, a mule, and he goes round and he surveys what's there. Some places he can't even get round the edge of the wall because there's so much rubble, so much debris. All the gates have gone. The place is a mess. And at that point, most human beings would say, well, I've had enough. Job's too big. Can't do it. Not only is the job too big, but everybody's against us. But no, Nehemiah's working with God, isn't he? He knows God is on his side. And he inspires the people to work. And there's a great long list in chapter 3 of those that did the work. And again, many of you know the record here. We don't need to go into a lot of the details. Of course, when there's work to be done, not everybody does it, do they? There's workers, there's shirkers. Of the workers, there's some unusual ones. Bearing in mind that what we're talking about is rebuilding a wall. That's putting stone upon stone, shifting heavy stones, putting them together. And until you've built the wall and got it sorted, you can't start to think about gates and timber and all that sort of thing. This is very heavy, laborious, manual work. And yet, who gets involved? Levites? Priests? Goldsmiths? Verses 8, 31 and 32 mentions goldsmiths. That's interesting, isn't it? You know, little things bring out the veracity of the scriptures. How many of you who have had any dealings at all with goldsmiths will know that it is a big Jewish trade, isn't it? And yet these people are working with fine things. You don't expect them to be humping boulders and labouring. Even more so, verse 8 talks about perfume makers. Now, don't ask me what perfume makers, Jewish perfume makers, were doing going back there. But that was their trade, but that's not what they were doing. These are perhaps delicate people, but they're getting stuck in because that's the work of God. And it wasn't just a male concern. Verse 12 tells us of the daughters of a particular man who got stuck in. most enthusiastic, because they appear three times, were people from Tekoa. Now, that's actually the hometown of Amos the prophet. That's got nothing to do with this. But these were ordinary people. But they're nobles. Oh, no, this is beneath us. We can't do that. So there was a distinction. This wasn't all the people. This was those that were willing. Any of you who have worked on a project know that if you've got half a dozen willing people, they're better than a dozen who don't really want to be there and have got every excuse for not doing it. These were willing workers. And when we say workers, they worked hard. Verse 10 of Nehemiah 4. Meanwhile, the people in Judah said, "The strength of the labourers is giving out, and there's so much rubble that we cannot rebuild the wall. Also, our enemies said, before they know it or see it, we will be right there among them. We will kill them and put an end to the work." And the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times over, "Wherever you turn, they will attack us." These are Jews telling other Jews, "Hey, you can't do it. You're not up to it. You can't sort it out." What also was happening is the Jews were taking advantage. Nehemiah 5 talks about all the things that the elders or the nobles were doing to the rest of the people. They were taking advantage. They were charging for food. They were selling their countrymen as slaves. They were charging usury on loans. You know, anybody that's ever had a thing about the Jews is all about lending money, isn't it? Shakespeare wrote about it. Shylock. It's sort of a natural trait. There they were, taking advantage of their own people at a time when they should have been concentrating on building. But Nehemiah was in control. Nehemiah 5 and verse 12. "We will give it back," they said. "We will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, 'In this way may God shake out of his house and possessions every man who does not keep this promise. So may such a man be shaken out and emptied.' At this the whole assembly said, 'Amen,' and praised the Lord, and the people did as they had promised." And we find Nehemiah too set a marvellous example himself. A marvellous example. An example that he didn't take nobility's food. He didn't take the food of governors. He ate with the normal, ordinary people. With the result that the work progressed, despite all of the opposition, despite all of the problems, they planned and they worked together. The wall gets finished. Nehemiah 6, verse 15. "So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. 52 days. We are talking about 80 years after the original return, and now the actual wall of Jerusalem is rebuilt. "When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God." It's one thing to know that God is on your side. It's one thing to believe in God and make your actions show that you believe in him. It takes it to another level when actually those who are in direct opposition to you have to respect your belief in God and realize that God is working with you, and so become disillusioned. What an example. What an example. Of course, it wasn't easy sailing. this business of re-establishing the people needed them to know what the law of Moses was about. And Ezra comes back on the scene, doesn't he, to reinstill in the people what the law of Moses meant to them, their commitment, their responsibilities. What would happen to them again if they disobeyed God? And he and Nehemiah are so inspiring that the people actually agree to do what they've been asked to do. One little bit of the verse, or end of verse 39 of Nehemiah 10. We will not neglect the house of our God. We're back to a full circle now. The temple of God has been rebuilt. The walls of the city have been rebuilt. The nation is united as one, worshipping God. And you'd think, well, that's it. It's all right. I'm sure that Nehemiah himself thought, well, it'll be all right. I promised that I would go out to the land for 12 years. I need to fulfill my part of the promise. And so he went back to Babylon. Of course, his back was turned. Things fall into disarray almost immediately. You can imagine that those enemies were always waiting for an opportunity. Once Nehemiah wasn't there to inspire the people, they soon moved in again. And the corruption went right to the top. One of the non-Jews was even allowed to use a storeroom in the temple to carry on his business and his trade. And I'm sure Nehemiah had despaired of all this, and in fact we know he does, because he put some personal comments in towards the end of his book. So, summary is not that brilliant, really. Despite all the work of Ezra and Nehemiah, nothing really changed. The people went away from God. Because they went away from God, they lost control of the city. They lost control of their land. Got taken away from them. They again were exiled. 6 million of them perished in the Second World War. But they're back in the land now. Restoration is happening again. They don't acknowledge God yet. They haven't established a proper temple on the mountain of God, but it will be restored. Jerusalem will be the capital of the whole world. Men will worship God in a new temple, because the truth of it is, no matter what man does, God's purpose will take place. We can follow the example and be inspired by Ezra, Nehemiah, and those others that worked to do this rebuilding, because there's going to be more rebuilding that needs to be done. We pray for the time when Christ will be back in the earth, and that we will be his instruments in rebuilding and establishing the kingdom.